It's 12:09 PM, you're at the Naturopathic Medical Board meeting. I'd like to take a moment to introduce Ms. Anthony, our Executive Director, and Mr. Rayner, who is our Assistant Attorney General.
Hello, everybody.
He's new with us, so he gets to experience it today.
Is this permanent, or is this just temporary for today?
Permanent.
Thank you. Hi, nice to meet you.
So, I'm going to let Ms. Anthony do our call, basically do our roll call for us.
Dr. Rubin?
Present.
Dr. Scott?
Present.
Ms. Gallant?
Here.
Dr. Popio?
Here.
Dr. Savick?
Here.
We have quorum.
Number two, declaration of conflict of interest. I'm going to recuse myself on Dr. Crisman. And anyone else have anything else? I saw there was a note on you, Dr. Rubin.
Yep, but I think they already pulled it out.
We already got that.
I pulled it out.
Okay. All right. What I'd like to do is do the civility statement very quickly. In accordance with the open meeting law, the board has a civility policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out its business. Anyone violating this policy will be asked to modify their behavior. If you can't modify your behavior, we'll have to remove from the room. What I'd like to do is run four, if we can, take four all the way through. And I'll need a motion. Take four all the way, A through K.
Make a motion, we approve 4A through K.
Second.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Dr. Scott?
Aye.
Ms. Gallant?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Dr. Savick?
Aye.
Motion carries.
That brings us on to number five, and we'll do 5A. Is Catherine here? Gail, could you give us just a brief summation on it?
Board members, this is case number 19-112. This complaint came to the board by way of information supplied by Dr. Mitchell from Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine. Dr. Mitchell supplied the board with an email chain indicating someone called the college attempting to confirm Ms. Bolinski's credentials. Dr. Mitchell confirmed Ms. Catherine Bolinski did not contact Southwest College requesting information. However, she did contact the college but never attended. As part of the investigation, the internet search disclosed exhibit one where Ms. Bolinski uses the term, "My name is Katrine Bolinski. I am naturopathic physician, SIC, functional medicine practitioner and co-founder of the Institute of Natural Health Sciences." And she signs it, Katrine Bolinski, ND. So, exhibit two, she uses natural health practitioner and the credential ND. Exhibit three, she talks about limiting to only two new patients a month. Exhibit four, she calls herself a naturopath and naturopathic health coach. Exhibit five, she's located in Sedona, Arizona, and calls herself a naturopathic physician. Exhibit six, she claims to be a naturopathic physician multiple times. Exhibit seven, there is no medical education degree disclosed on this website. And exhibit eight is the statutes. On January 31st, 2019, the notice of complaint was mailed to Ms. Bolinski. On February 19th, 2019, Ms. Bolinski supplied her response to the board. In her response, she states, in part, "Following a review of the exhibits you provided, I understand why your organization would have concerns, as even I was unaware of how my health story had been used by others. I have never stated, published, or alluded that I was a graduate of Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine. The only affiliation I have with SCNM is that I applied and was admitted but not able to attend due to limited financial resources. I do not practice naturopathy and would never claim such, as I know I would damage my reputation and prevent further educational opportunities." According to Dr. Mitchell from Southwest College, Ms. Belinsky was a candidate for admission but never completed the process in 2012.
So I'll basically, I think we should just refer this to the Attorney General and or the county attorney for possible further action.
So moved.
Unless you have another.
And we got that motion.
Okay, yeah, that's my motion.
Okay, then I second your motion.
Okay.
May I do roll call? Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Dr. Sabat?
Aye.
Motion carries.
All right, moving on to case number 19-124. This is Dr. Kuzman. Gail, would you give us a brief on that one as well?
On April 24th, 2019, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a phone call from an unidentified individual requesting verification of the naturopathic medical license for Jeannie Kuzman. Board staff confirmed Jeannie Kuzman was not a licensed naturopathic physician in the state of Arizona and relayed that information to the caller. Further investigation via internet search revealed evidence of Dr. Krisman's possible use of the protected title. Exhibit one, she calls herself a certified biological dentist and naturopathic physician. She claims she's has board certification by the American Board of Integrative Medicine and Dentistry and the American Naturopathic Medicine Association. We have three examples of her using the term naturopathic doctor or terms to lead the public to believe that she is a licensed naturopathic physician in the state of Arizona.
My question just to the other board members is, or just to the executive director, is what is this certifying board that she's even talking about? I didn't know if you knew anything, Dr. Rubin, about this.
Well,
I just don't know if you knew anything about, she's claiming to be certified by the ANMCB. So it's, she's claiming certification out of a group out of Vegas.
Yeah, I think we've run into this many times. We nicknamed this group the UNDs, that are not recognizable, that are recognized by the AAMP, that are consistent with naturopathic physicians, that are not licensable in the state, that is at the board exams, they're not considered physicians in the eyes of the board. And in my professional opinion, they're a danger to the public. And so this board is here to protect the public, and therefore we should take action that's necessary. Now, Caleb, I honestly can't read some of this. I'm sorry, there's definitely something wrong with my computer, just maybe it's my eyes, but I read through so I have a memory of it. If I remember, she's a DMD,
yep,
and seemed to be like, oh my God, I didn't know this was happening, and seemed to make preparations pretty
right,
quickly.
For sure. I just didn't know if there was anything, I know our national agency is working against this, but I just didn't know if there was anything union was specifically related to this or
I think the schools may know more about this.
Okay. Then I make a motion that we move this to the Attorney General.
I will second that motion.
Roll call, please. Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, we're going to roll on to 5D. Is Dr. Youssef here?
Yes.
Can you come on up when you have a chance? Is the complaint in here? Okay. I'm going to let him go first, then we'll hear from you. Is that clear? Yes? Okay. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Let me, as soon as I got you up here, Dr. Youssef, we'll do it, then we'll roll back to Dr. O'Hara. And let's see if I have a chance to have to review that.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, this is board case number 19125. On May 19th, 2019, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from patient M.A. In her complaint, M.A. stated she presented to Dr. Yosef on April 30th, 2019 with hurting lumps all over my head and temples, throat muscles and jaw muscles, soreness, and severe pain, end quote. M.A. alleges respondent misdiagnosed her with viral infection when she actually had giant cell enteritis. M.A. requested a full refund from respondent of $702.57. Respondent refused to give her the total refund, but did give her a partial refund of $97.25.
Dr. Yosef?
Yeah.
Your comments?
Actually, I want to just start by hanging out. I have a handout for the update on the management of giant cell arteritis. I wanted to give you guys a copy of that, please, to review. First of all, I want to say that I feel very, you know, bad for the patient of what she went through. I understand she was going through a painful process. She was frustrated, and quite frankly, I understand her frustration. She had been to the ER. She had been to another physician. She had also been referred to an endodontist, I believe, or a dentist. I don't know if you're a specialist. It's a very difficult diagnosis to make. When she came to me, she had been to the emergency room the week prior, and they didn't diagnose her. They didn't know what she had. I mean, her ESR, her sediment rate was high. Clearly, there was a lot of inflammation, but it was not, I don't know what, they didn't really run much testing. They should have really done an MRI. Maybe with contrast, I would have picked it up. It wasn't done. She came to me. She's on Access as well. So I have limited resources, so I couldn't really, I don't work with Access. I was trying to do what I could under the circumstances. In the process, I determined that she had, based on the presentation and my own testing, I determined she had a viral infection, herpes simplex. And actually, through the literature, I provided the board with some background. In fact, actually, I came across more information recently that shows that there's a clear correlation between GCA, formerly known as temporal arthritis, and giant cell arthritis. And so treating the, in fact, so much so that the handout that I provided you guys with indicates, it was actually updated on February 23rd, 2017. And if you turn to page 75 on that handout, I don't know who has it, but it basically, it reads as follows. While the generally considered an autoimmune disease of unknown etiology, interest has recently been renewed in the possible role of Varicella zoster, which is one of the other viruses very commonly present in this, in the GCA pathogenesis. VCV, otherwise known as Varicella zoster virus, is a virus of interest because of its ability to lie latent in nerve root ganglions after primary infection, just as the herpes simplex, and reactivate many years later. It has been shown to replicate within intracerebral blood vessels, resulting in manifestations such as ischemic stroke, and biopsy of Varicella zoster infected cerebral arteries, which reveals granulomatous arthritis with similar histopathological findings to those of GCA. So the presentation is very typical for the infection. However, the mainstream establishment is thought you prescribe steroids, which is fine for management, but there's clearly more and more they're realizing the effect of, or the correlation with viral infection. That actually in the bottom, you can see to date, a few case reports describe improvement in symptoms with the addition of IV acyclovir, which we cannot do, to prednisone. So I did a hydrogen peroxide IV, prompting some authors to advocate for combined treatment with a high dose glucocorticoids and valacyclovir, 1 gram TID and GCA. So, you know, I made the recommendation based on what I found. I actually, because I was limited in resources, I just said, why don't you do your IgG, IgM for herpes to see if it comes up, but actually, as I know, look at the literature, it doesn't come up on blood tests. So that's only can come up with a temporal arteritis biopsy, which most people don't do. So it's very much, the diagnosis was good, it's not mutually exclusive. In fact, it's very much correlated to the diagnosis. And secondly, the treatment was very much correlated to the diagnosis. So that's, I gave her the, I felt bad, and I was caught between patients. So, you know, when she came and approached me, I was, you know, I just said, listen, I can't refund you. I have a lot of expense. I try to help people. I'm all about helping people. So people are approaching me consistently for discounts, and I try to help when I can. I saw she was in financial need. I understand that. But at the same time, I said, listen, I have a practice here. I have employees. I can't just give out. You know, so I refunded her for the things she had not opened. It was not, She looked very angry. She rolled her eyes to the back of her head. And I mean, and I understand that she was frustrated, but it was like a personal thing. There's no personal issue. I handled the situation as best as any physician could have handled it. And in fact, it went to the true root of the problem, which is not really the arthritis, not really an immune condition alone. It really has a root cause in an infectious viral condition. So that is my two cents on the whole thing. I don't know when she saw. I also told her to see the internist. She was going to see the internist anyway, so I said just take that blood work to him, see any treatment that he can do. Continue, you know, and do the IVs as, you know, until the symptoms try to work together, so we can determine what this is. But based on the resources that I had, that's what I could do. And in fact, if it speaks negatively on anybody's clinical diagnosis abilities, it was more on the ER and the other doctor that was missed. I mean, it is an elusive diagnosis. You come across this diagnosis maybe once in a lifetime. And, you know, so I think it was handled appropriately. And considering she was trying to get, you know, I actually worked her into the schedule. She was having, she was really needing to get in. So I actually typically would not let a patient in, but she persisted in wanting to get a visit. She was referred by another patient, so I tried to really accommodate her. I regret having done that because this has happened, but at the same time, I'm there to help. So this is what transpired, and that's what I have to say.
Just so that I'm clear with the sequential aspects of this, she went to the emergency room. She also went to endodontics. This is all prior to seeing
me. Prior to seeing me, okay. Yes. She has seen at least two doctors prior to seeing me.
In the emergency room.
You have the chart notes. It shows the sed rate was high.
Right.
I don't know why they didn't run a CT. I mean, they have all the resources there.
Yes.
So that wasn't, you know, they should have really done the workup better. And I know it's a difficult diagnosis to make, but you don't see any visible signs except the lumps that started developing. But you could see the pattern. Based on the history, that's why I knew there was a viral infection. It started with the ganglion. You know, someone did a ganglion. She was feeling pain there, radiated to the teeth. That's why they thought it was a dental problem. Then started spreading, you know, the trigeminal nerve, then started spreading to the, you know, the forehead in that area, which is very much correlated to viral infection. The internist that she saw said, no, you just need steroids. And so she came to me, she said, well, you misdiagnosed, you're giving the wrong treatment. Of course, it's going to treat with steroids, but actual literature, if you're up to date, it shows how significant it improves the actual recovery rate, as well as the long-term effects, because she has a latent viral infection, it can lead to problems down the road.
So if you were to treat this again, would you have treated it in the same manner you did?
Absolutely.
Okay. Would you have given steroids or acyclovir?
I mean, I would probably have given steroids, obviously, because knowing that would be, I would combine the two treatments, of course.
Right.
But I didn't have the, I couldn't do a biopsy.
Sure.
I didn't, you know, it was very difficult to, with limited information that I had. Yes, I would have added the steroids, but I would have combined it certainly with the antiviral treatment.
Okay. So your game plan would have been, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your game plan would have been that type of treatment, possibly intravenous treatments, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And with the hydrogen peroxide, I would take it you probably normally would write on your chart note how many cc's.
Yeah, we did, and I made a note when I replied that you'll see they didn't stamp it in there, but absolutely. And I explained what was in there.
Okay.
Yeah. Of course.
Hey, Doctor, how did you come to the diagnosis of viral infection?
The presentation, number one, and I use electrodermal testing, but I never rely on that solely. So I basically, that's why I said do the IgG and IgM testing, and the presentation, to me, the presentation was clear. She had a high fever, she developed all these symptoms very acutely. She, the pattern of presentation. And then with the electrodermal testing, I was able to pinpoint the herpes virus, so I had her test for that. And then I looked up, I was looking up literature on that. So, and I found that there was actually herpes simplex. I provided the board with a copy. There's this 88% of temporal artery biopsies actually have the PCR genetic marker for the herpes simplex, and 86% for the herpes zoster. So there's a clear correlation there.
Okay, and your treatment plan was herpanosine?
Yes.
DHT?
Yes.
Desbio herpes simplex?
Correct.
Therapeutic food?
Yes.
Transfer factor, and I couldn't read the last one.
I don't have my chart notes.
Nutrislin?
Sorry? Nutrislin? Maybe, no, Nutrislin Silver. It's probably Nutrislin, yeah, Chlorosilver, yes.
So that's all oral. What's BHT?
BHT is actually, it's a preservative, but it's actually been used to, it actually breaks down the cell wall of the virus. Yes.
In the hydroxychloroquine.
Correct.
In a supplement.
In a supplement, yeah.
And herpanosine, what's in herpanosine?
It's got actually sarsaparilla, it's got lysine, it's got other herbs, and it's got zinc. It's a combination herbal and mineral supplement specific to herpes-related infections.
So regardless of whether or not you made a diagnosis of germ cell arthritis,
yes,
there still is the potential for the patient to have had a viral infection associated with it, whether or not it's diagnosed.
Absolutely, 88% likely.
And so these products are still useful.
Correct.
In the case.
Correct.
Okay, Dr. Yusuf, I have you go ahead and take a seat, and we'll hear from MA. Aye.
Aye. And I apologize, my hearing is bad, so I didn't hear. I was trying to hear as best as I could, but was missing parts. So
we can always repeat.
I'm sorry.
If you have a question for us, we can always repeat what we said too, if you need to hear it.
Okay.
We pretty much heard from Dr. Yusuf, so go ahead and tell us what transpired.
Well, basically what I wrote and sent in, and that I ended up initially with my jaw was swollen when I got up one morning. And so I thought, okay, well, it's a tooth, maybe an infection or whatever. So I immediately got a hold of my dentist that I need to get in right away. I think I have an infection. And so he took me in right away. And he did x-rays and stuff and did a manual examination and said, he couldn't find anything. He sent me that day right over to the endodontist and had him look at me, and he then examined me, and same thing, he said he didn't find anything as far as the teeth and the gums. He suggested that I go see the ENT, which I then made the appointment right away, went and saw the ENT. And again, by that time, more things had developed. I had lumps all over my head, not just my jaw then. I had come out all over my head. I was in lots of pain. Just extreme pain. And so then when I went to the ENT, again, he couldn't give me a name, what was going on. He didn't know. And he suggested a medication at the time, but I was like, I don't know what's happening either. I said, how is that going to help me? And he said, well, if you can't tell me what it is. And then he goes, I don't know. So then by that was by the weekend, by Friday, and then I was in so much pain that, and I'm, for me, like if you did a scale of 1 to 10, I felt like I was at a 20. And so I ended up in the ER. Okay, so the ER, they did a CAT scan. They came and checked me out through and gave me morphine while I was there for the pain. And then through the time that I was there to the morning, and then they came and they couldn't tell me by the blood test and the CAT scan and that there was nothing that came up that they could say it was this. So they suggested that I go see a, the skin person.
Dermatologist.
Yes. And so I went, made an appointment and got in right away there. And again, I still have all this pain. She then did a biopsy while I was there, but it was too superficial. She did it right here and did the biopsy. And so at that point, and I didn't wait for those results to come back at that point, because she couldn't confirm something and did that. And Yosef had given me two blood tests. And so because insurance doesn't pay for any of that stuff, I called then at that point my internal medicine doctor. And I I said, you know, I need to come in and I need to get, you know, this stuff is happening, I need these blood tests. So I went in and she says, what's going on? And then, you know, she could see what was happening, the lumps and all that. She says, told her everything I've gone through. She goes, well, I want blood tests on my own. And so I'm like, okay, you know. So she did those, the ones that he had sent over, she did those, but she did her own also. By that afternoon, she called me back and she said, your SED rate is at 97. And she said, it's off the charts. And she said, and I got that, and she says, I had this looking at everything. She goes, and I went and I consulted one of the associates and who's had a couple of these cases before, and he confirmed the symptoms. And she goes, I'm pretty sure you have GCA. And she goes, I'm gonna put you on the prednisone right now. She said, because the, what can happen with that, and I went, of course, looked up on the internet and checked everything out too, is that I could have gone blind. That's like number one in there with the GCA,
right,
without being controlled by the prednisone. And so she put me on that, and then of course from that we went through the other steps to absolutely confirm it. She had me go see a surgeon and set that up, and I went in and he cut all the way up in here and took a large piece out of here, and they biopsied it, and it came back positive for GCA. And so at that point, you know, then I was like, because I talked to my internal medicine about, you know, that this herpes, the HSV was suggested in that, and then she goes, no, she says, this is your arteries, and she said, it's inflammation in the body, and it swells up the blood vessels. And that's why the blindness can come into effect, because that happens. And so at that point then I went back to Joseph's office, as I heard him saying I had gone back in there, and then to his apothecary that he has in his office, and I said, I can't use these. I got a diagnosis. I have GCA. I have to go this route. And they said, well, we can't refund those. You opened those boxes. And I said, but I did it on the basis of, I was told that it was a viral infection and that I should use this. And so at that point I said, well, I would like to speak to him. So then I did, and I went in, he took me back to a little cubbyhole and talked with him there. And he said, well, he goes, I'm sorry. He goes, but you know, that's why I have a sign out there. We don't refund money. And I said, but you gave me a diagnosis of HSV, and you gave me this medicine for that, specifically some of this that you gave me. I can't use it. I have to be on this prednisone from everything that I was told by the doctors and everything that I looked up beyond that myself. And then he goes, well, yeah, that's our policy. And I said, well, okay, what about it, you know? At least half, go half back, give me half my money back. You know, that's over $700. That's a lot of money for me. That's a lot of money. And then he goes, no. He goes, I have 9 employees to that I have to pay their salary. And I said, well, I am a sole provider for myself, and I have mortgage and a car and all my bills too. Anyway, so that's how that happens, you know. And since then, I have also gone, from that point, I've also been, gone to the cardiologist, because the heart, it affects the heart, this GCA, and it can cause aneurysms. And so I've gone and I had to go see the cardiologist. I've had to wear one of the pacemakers to monitor, also then they sent me after that, to the rheumatologist, and I went into him, and he said that he thinks that, you know, what would really help me out, besides being on, like, not getting off the prednisone just yet, but there's this other medicine that's called Actemra that's been in existence, he said, for the last decade, and it works for different things, but one of the things that works on is the GCA. And so, anyhow, I had to go. That has nothing to do with this case or him, but I had to go through a lot of steps of calling different companies because that medicine is just astronomical. And I called many different companies and finally found one that would assist me, and they are providing that medication for me. So, and in the before that, after I had been in Yosef's office, and then I get this in the mail from him, and it's a printout, and it's about high prevalence of herpes simplex, which I think he probably was talking about when he was sitting here, virus DNA and temporal arteritis biopsy specimens. But in this particular pages, these pages that he sent, there is a place right here where it says, and I don't bring my glasses up with me, where it says, we do not know whether HSV is a causative agent of TA or merely a bystander. So, you know, it's not conclusive, you know, that has anything to do with it, that it's attached to it. But with all of that, you know, and what I found out, and the fact that I was, you know, I feel that if I hadn't stopped there and thought, okay, and I didn't stop because it did nothing to relieve all the pain I was in. It did nothing to reduce the lumps that were all over my head, it meaning when I was in his office, the IV, and then what he had given me. So I feel that, you know, had I stopped there, that I could be blind right now. And I didn't stop there because there was still all of the pain. There was the blood work, of course, to still follow through. And then when I went to the internal medicine doctor, you know, then they said, this is what you've got. And then they put me on the prednisone. That actually stopped the pain, reduced everything.
Have you also lodged complaints against all of the other providers with misdiagnosis?
None of the other providers gave me a diagnosis. They didn't say, you have this. Nobody knew what it was. So nobody said, you have this, and here, let me give you this medicine. Take this, and that's going to...
But that would be as negligent, just sending you out the door saying, we don't know what's going on, as you're saying his diagnosis is. Them saying, just go home and here's your pain medication. That's essentially saying, I'm sorry.
Basically, they were saying, they led me on to the next one. Go try this, you know, I don't know. Try this one. Try this doctor. Try this area of expertise. So no one said, this is what you have, and here, let us give you the medication for it. My thing here, and with my complaint with this, is that I was told specifically that it was, you know, HSV, that it was a viral infection, and here's medicine, take this, you know. I tried to go back and say, you know, this doesn't work for me. I tried to say, even to the point of saying, look, just go in half with me if you're not going to, you know, even take any responsibility on this.
What is the cause of your GCA?
They don't even know.
Right. Thank you. So you've been to experts who can't tell you what the cause is.
I'm sorry?
That you've been to experts who can't tell you what the cause is. You were told to go see dermatology by an emergency department that, with all the high technology that they have, were still unable to diagnose you. You're complaining about one of our doctors who told you that you probably had a viral disease and treated you, and you can't tell me that it's not a viral disease. We can't tell you that it is for sure, but it's a lot farther down the line than giving you an antibody to interleukin-6. That's that camera drug. And so my question is, why are you saying that he misdiagnosed you? I'm not saying he completely diagnosed you, but I want to argue with you, then, why do you think he actually misdiagnosed you? Because the product that he gave you, the antibodies that he ran, reading through your internist notes as well, I don't know that he did misdiagnose you. He may be the one that's helping you from a cause perspective, which is one of the highest precepts of naturopathic medicine. So I understand what you're saying about he didn't say, oh, go to the next doctor. But he also didn't necessarily misdiagnose you, and you're saying that he did. But you also can't tell me that anybody can tell you the cause. I don't know if you've even asked anybody.
Are you asking me a question now?
So I asked you what the cause was. No, I'm not asking you a question. I'm just making a statement. But I'm also curious why you didn't find fault in what happened at the emergency department.
they didn't give me a diagnosis. They didn't say this is what your problem is. No one did until I got to the internal medicine doctor.
Right.
And she said, from the test that she ran and my symptoms, she said, this is what I believe you have. She gave me the prednisone. No. Am I a doctor? Absolutely not. Am I a naturopath? No. Do I have the definitive answers as to yay, nay? No. I'm going by what I've been told, what I've looked up, and talking to my internal medicine doctor, you know, yes, she thought that, that the AHSV has nothing to do with it. Yes, I was told that.
Okay.
And also the biopsy showed nothing towards AHSV.
So in medicine, especially when there's a gray area such as in GCA, because we don't know, GCA, I don't manage patients with GCA, but I'm reading the literature in front of me, and this looks like the most modern stuff from what Dr. Yosef sent to you, and the lines that you read to us said that it's unknown whether or not there is definitively a role for HSV or viral infections in GCA, but it doesn't say that there's not. Furthermore, this update, 2017, and the management of patients with GCA does demonstrate that there are patients who have improved with the addition of antivirals. I'm just letting you know what the current knowledge is.
You mentioned reading online a number of info, reading for information. In your reading, what did you determine would be a underlying cause for the inflammation? Because essentially, prednisone just is a big dose drug to stop inflammation.
Right.
But why is inflammation there in the first place?
Like I said, everything that I've read on the GCA, they don't have a definitive answer as to what causes it.
Correct.
So
when your white blood cells are high on your lab work, there's a suspicion that there's an underlying infection, whether it be viral or bacterial, but I don't think he's at all off track in assuming that there's an underlying infectious etiology for why you get the level of swelling, pain, inflammation that you have. So I agree with Dr. Rubin that while we don't have proof that there is a viral component, we certainly have data that suggests that there may be a component of that. And that's why I think he's appropriate in the way he was treating you for the most part. So I understand your frustration with this, but you know, when you're talking about, oh, they gave you a diagnosis, that is true, but they also just gave you a suppressive medication that doesn't deal with why you got the GCA in the first place. So now you're left with suppressive medications, still not knowing why you ever got this in the first place. So.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you think that had I not done anything else but took this, what he gave me, that I wouldn't have gone blind?
I doubt you would have, because I would have assumed that if you had followed up on the treatment plan after 4 to 5 days of getting IVs and not seeing improvement, he probably would have referred you. But I also understand that it was both your understandings that you were also proceeding to the internist the next day. So given that it was a team approach to finding out what was going on with your care, in no way, shape, or form do I think you would have gone blind given the number of providers that were involved in your care.
Right, I went on to the internal medicine doctor, but he didn't know I was going there.
He did, because he wrote you a script for labs that said, go get these done with your
primary. He gave me a script to go get the labs done. It wasn't where I was going to get them done or anything.
Okay. Well, I'm understanding a little bit different based on what he commented on in his testimony.
Let me digress for a moment. If this had to be redone, what would you have like him to do? Initially give you the prednisone and blanket the approach that way? What would have been, do you think, the most efficacious route you could have taken?
No, I actually understand that, you know, from going to all of the other doctors that I went to of the different areas of practice, people didn't have answers. They didn't know. Somebody didn't know. What my thing was, and you know, not that he had to have, that he had to have a knowledge and had to have known, you know, but the fact that it was, he said, this is what, you know, what's happening. I went to the internal, I found out it's this, I get this medicine. When I go back, ultimately it was when I went back and talked to him after spending, like I said, over $700 and saying, you know, this is what I have. This is what I've been told I have. This is what I'm on now. I don't feel that this is going to work for me. and, you know, a refund, and he absolutely refused, you know? So the, I guess the, that other end of it, the human compassion of the fact that, okay, so maybe this wasn't what you needed, let me help you out here and with, you know, all the money you spent. So that was the part of it that just was like.
It was frustrating for you. Because I've treated GCA, I may have treated it a little bit different than he treated it, but there's, you know, an etiology of some sort that probably caused it, whether it was autoimmune, whether it was HSV6 or any of the other, you know, viral patterns. And I understand your frustration with going so long and actually, you know, probably in a lot of pain. I think what he was trying to do was look for the basement level, I'm not going to speak for him, and then try to, you know, treat from that point. We'll bring him back up. Is there anything else you'd like to say? Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Dr. Youssef? And when she clears up, can you come on up here?
We're
going to switch people. Thank you.
So I would just state that I didn't discourage her from continuing. I did say, listen, this is what I think you have. Continue seeking out the interest. I gave her, do this blood work at least, and do continue. I didn't say, this is the end, stop shopping. I didn't say I had all the answers. I never, in this legal patient, have all the answers. But I said, this is, I think, is definitely one of the root causes of your presentation. You know, I understand the compassion component, and I guess for me, of course, as a doctor, I do try to, you know, convey compassion. I just felt when she came in, it kind of, with her approach when she came in, I understood we were both rushed. I was in the middle of seeing patients. It was kind of like, oh, well, you misdiagnosed me. Everything you did for me was wrong. And I didn't feel that. I didn't feel like I had done the wrong thing. So for me, giving her the money would have said, oh, yeah, you're right. You did misdiagnose me. It would kind of, you know, supported her story. So, you know, helping her out financially, that's one thing. Okay, so I can work that out with her. But her attitude was kind of like she diminished the work that I did. And basically the interest undermined. Actually, and to be honest, he is lacking. He's not up to date on the literature. The literature is suggesting otherwise. So I think we were ahead on that end as far as the treatment plan and as far as what she was doing. Yes, if she would have followed the recommended IV sequence, we've been back-to-back twice a week, the hydrogen peroxide, and then everything else, I think she would have been, she could have potentially recovered with that alone. We don't know. Nobody will know the answer to that.
If you saw within, because you have a limited time for treatment for this.
Yeah.
So if you saw within 24 or 48 hours, no progression.
Of course.
You don't have a lot, yeah. Would you then have resorted to?
Of course. I never.
That's my concern.
Yeah, I would have never told her, you know, symptoms worsen or anything. I said, go to the ER. I've just been to the ER, so I mean, I think we should have been a little concerned about returning there. But I, you know, if anything gets worse, of course you go back to ER and you can seek out answers. And I did say, like, continue to go wherever you need to go to. But in the meantime, just this is what I recommend. To get you on track. It was limited for me because she's an access. I couldn't.
Right.
So I don't work with access. I mean, this is the reality. And I'm sorry that treatments are costly, but, you know, this is the cost of running a practice.
But where I'm heading is, if you had to, would you have initiated
absolutely
the other therapeutics?
And I've got an interest. Also, yes. And okay. I have also an interest that I work with closely. So we had just started. You know, she had been also at that point. Been through several practitioners. So there's an interest that I work closely with, and he would have been happy to manage more. But at that point, we wouldn't even give it a chance. You know, it was very sudden when she went to see the other internist, which was fine. So she had somebody to go to, so I didn't really resort to the guy that I work with. But I would work as a team. That was my goal, was not to take over the treatment and say, this is all you need to do. I never suggested that. That's not my goal.
And why did you give a discount?
Because those were the policies. I can't resell what's open. So the ones that were open.
I'm saying that, like, your first office visit and your IV charges, you gave a discount the date of service, I believe, too. One of them shows you charge $250 and actually only charge you $200, and then you gave her a discount.
Because you know what? I squeezed her in between patients. So actually, I made my day. I had to put my other patients to wait. And because I took less time with her, to be honest, I charged her accordingly. So. In fact, I did try to be take into account those things. I try to be ethical. I mean, I'm not perfect, but I think I try to handle as best as I could. That's why I felt, you know, I feel like patients sometimes don't realize they come to you and yes, you want to help, but it's also and I've become a little less willing to give people money because I've seen people that come and they want money. And I see them driving out of Mercedes. You know, it's like it's not right. You know, and I help as much as I can, but I also felt undermined. I felt that, you know, she was not very. Her approach to me was also not very gentle. She didn't come to me, you know, in a nice way. Like, it was kind of like, and she rolled her eyes to the back of her head when she was, because I wasn't willing to work with her. I know she was frustrated, but I didn't feel good about the situation.
Do you know what time period it was from when the patient had been to the emergency department?
That was being like, I believe it was a Thursday or Friday prior, so it had been like three to 4 days prior to that. I don't have my chart note, so you're getting some.
In your note, you said patient has access and cannot afford doing any blood work with us, nor imaging.
Right.
However, she's planning to follow up with her internist. So
that was my understanding. I said, if anything goes, you can follow up with the internist. So that's what I said to her.
And so I'm also recommending that she follow up with her internist and have said blood tests.
Correct.
Given that it came up on testing, electrodermal, and it is also known to be a common cause of trigeminal neuralgia, which was your warning diagnosis.
Yes.
The rapid onset of symptoms, which you recognized,
yes,
and the severity of her condition, and I'm believing you mean her symptomatology versus your objective findings.
Correct.
Point to an infection.
Correct.
I don't think that that's far off. I think that in a clinic with no diagnostic capabilities except what you have in office, which was not going to be at any additional cost to her.
Right.
Okay. The pain and lesion pattern resembles that of trigeminal neuralgia. However, the hematomas don't fit its typical presentation.
Correct.
And an MRI imaging with contrast can reveal more information, but a patient has to stay within her insurance network to get coverage, which you knew she was headed over to her doctor where she
right. Eventually, they would run an image.
And
necessary.
So, the only thing I'm thinking as a clinician in a high volume clinic that you could have done is if you were concerned about acuity or severity, is to refer to the emergency department where she had just been, who has every diagnostic capability, a team of physicians, unlike yourself, and still couldn't come up with the diagnosis, which giant cell arthritis often presents emergently. In an emergency situation. Is that true?
Yeah, right.
So I'm trying to find where you have fault, and I'm not finding it. I also see that you tried to treat what you found to be an underlying condition, regardless of how the secondary manifestations in the body, in this case GCA, in other cases viral infections. So most doctors don't give thought and explanation in their assessments. They would just give an ICD-10 code. You gave thought, and it's a good thing. It's how I write my charts, because you never know when you're going to need them, so keep doing that. So these are my thoughts on his notes. With this case, this particular doctor with whom we license.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really frustrating not to have a diagnosis and to probably spend quite a bit of money in the search for one, especially if that's hard for someone. So I just want to say I recognize the frustration. That being said, I'm not sure forcing somebody to give a refund, which would, I think, rise to the level of discipline in order for us to do something like that, is on the table here. I don't think that there's enough done wrong to, or, you know, even if we found something that was done wrong, rises to the level of discipline. So that's where I'm at with this, even though I do understand the frustration. The difficulty coming here today and explaining all that to us.
Thank you for bringing that up, that's true.
So, I think. Yes, go ahead.
If I just could make a comment, you asked the question, Ryan asked the question about the discount. You noticed there was a discount. What was told to me by the front desk at his office, that I was receiving a discount because I was signing up for multiple, I was going to come back for multiple IVs, and that's why I got the discount.
That's not for the visit, though.
Right. Excuse me?
That's not for the visit. The visit was discounted because it was less time.
Again, I'm not sure that that's
punishment that authorizes to discipline definitely is not anything that I would be in favor of.
I agree, so I'm gonna make a motion. I don't think you're able to forgive GCA, but I'm gonna make a motion that we dismiss this case.
I'll second that motion.
Roll call, please. Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Popiel?
Aye.
Dr. Sadler?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Very much.
Okay, let's digress for a moment. We'll move on to 5C. Dr. O'Hara, is she here?
Dr. Sadler, I did announce this before, but I'm needing to recuse. And if you're going to tell you why, I will.
Do you guys work together?
We did.
Okay. So
I'm finding it hard to be objective after Dr. O'Hara was a resident of mine many years ago.
Yes.
Okay. That's fine. So note, Dr. Rubin has recused on this case number 19-118.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, this is case 19-118. On February 25th, 2019, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received notification from the Arizona Department of Health Services of a discrepancy in the number of medical marijuana certifications written by respondent from July 1st, 2018 through December 31st, 2018. Versus the number of times she queried the Arizona Board of Pharmacy Controlled Substance Prescription Monitoring Program database, the PMP. According to the notice from DHS, from July 1st through December 31st, 2018, respondent certified 189 patients for medical marijuana. However, only accessed the queried the database 6 times. According to respondent, she was aware that the CSPMP is part of the certification process. However, was not aware it was a necessary component for every individual applying. As stated in her response, I thought my own assumption and lack of education regarding the issue that would be a secondary confirmation after medical records and physical exam of a person's candidacy only if there was inconclusive information. For example, if the person presented with a chart note or radiology report without medications included, the PMP would benefit the physician in clarifying prescriptions received and quantity. I did not fully understand this was absolutely required for each and every individual, end quote.
Dr. O'Hara?
Yes.
Do you have any comments?
I follow my response to the board. To be quite honest, July, which is the beginning of those dates that the DHS reviewed, that's when I started doing medical marijuana reviews. My background is, I have background in oncology with Dr. Rubin, but most of my 15 years have been spent in medical aesthetics. I was making a transition, so this was a new direction for me. So when I moved into this position, in transition, it's not a full-time position for me. The training was very minimal, and I realize it's ultimately my responsibility to do my due diligence and educate myself on the rules. As my response said, I didn't fully understand that the PMP was mandatory for each and every patient. And that is the gist of why I have a deficiency of a large amount of people. Since I've been notified by the board, I have do check every single patient. I have done retroactive PMP checks on those clients that I submitted from those dates to review whether those PMP reviews would have changed the certification process for those individuals.
And are you currently working for an organization that does?
I am.
Okay. And what's the general age bracket you're seeing come through that? 18?
18 to 85?
Yeah.
Big range.
And what's your procedure? Do you do an exam? Do you get the history? Do you check the records?
Yes. It's the organization I work for, they're quite good at pre-screening people, so generally they will not even be on my schedule unless they have current medical records. So those are either electronic or the patient will bring the medical records in with them. So generally it's a brief medical exam. So when they present, I treat them as if they're one of my, general patient clients. So, starting with the chief complaint, the complete soap note, provocation, location, quality of pain, medical history, medications that they're on, when their last office visit was, and what other alternative treatments they've tried in that course of action. And of course, in the objective, I'm doing vital signs and I'm doing a specified physical exam around whatever their chief complaint was, if I'm able to do so. And then in the plan, I am counseling them on the risk benefits of medical marijuana, if I have any more naturopathic suggestions to make for their progression, then I do so. They sign the attestation. I take a picture of them, their ID, their previous medical marijuana card, if it's been issued before, and that's the general office visit.
Okay. So there was an 18-year-old MA with menstruation in a regular cycle. Do you remember that one?
I remember that day specifically,
okay.
Because I'm always leery of an 18-year-old that comes in the door. I still remember she was accompanied by her mother and her younger sister, who was about 3 years old. And on the intake of her chief complaint, which was pelvic pain and diagnosed endometriosis, I had quite a discussion with her because I personally have a very invested interest because I have quite a history with that same diagnosis. So I was questioning her about some of her symptoms, what the suggestions were from her gynecologist at the time, which at the time were fairly severe for her age. And so we had a discussion about what other treatments she had tried, what she was willing to do for her pain.
And then how about the prescriptions, Tramadol and Xanax?
For her?
Were those given
to... That was not done through that office.
Okay.
Yeah, that's for aesthetics.
For aesthetics.
Yeah, the only time I really prescribe, as you can see, is for... They are not dispensed from the office, but we do a fairly aggressive laser treatment. So one Tramadol and one Xanax are generally prescribed one time only for those clients that were in the office.
On your chart notes, is that something that's provided by the facility you're working for, or is this representative of your chart notes in general?
That's representative of my chart notes in general for the medical marijuana. Specific notes or a template, so to speak. I should say that was provided in terms of the basic soap note. In terms of adding details, or some providers choose to use their own checklist, you're able to do that. But there's not one specific. They provide that template along with a lot of other recommendations and things like that, but a provider does not necessarily have to use that. There's different variations from different physicians.
Do you generally actually provide an ICD-10 code? Because most of what you've written down here is actually just endometriosis or nausea vomiting.
I actually do. I don't do it all the time. I noticed it's not required for the medical marijuana certifications. I usually do my best to include it, and most of the time I have to. If I need to look it up on the ICD-10 coding, then I do so.
So are you still doing certification for MMJ?
I am, but very, maybe half, two half days a week.
And I know you were
understand, it was just getting into something new, but even though that being said, on the form for medical marijuana, it says, I have looked at the PMP, how did we just go over the top of that?
I do, and I realize I'm checking, there's checking the list, right, on the certification, you're initialing and acknowledging that. I think my thought pattern is that is, I realized I was checking it, but not realizing it had to be for every single person. I thought it was supposed to be more so a backup for confirming if someone you thought was malingering, they didn't have sufficient records, if maybe I thought they were drug seeking, or many times a patient presents and they can't even remember what medications they're on. And so for that, that's admittedly my fault for not educating myself. And also I think the person that I chatted with someone for probably 3 hours at the most, and then I, you know, started my shift. I didn't witness her do that. It doesn't mean that she did not, because she had a computer in front of her, and I know a lot of clinicians will do it at home, wait till the certifications, depending on how many patients they're having time. So I do understand that I admittedly checked that box, acknowledging I was checking it. It was my responsibility to understand that it was, you know, it was mandatory, and I wasn't understanding that. It was not done out of intent.
I mean, the big problem that we have is that you, on the form, said that you did check.
I understand that.
The PMP. Okay. And what's your feeling about combining benzodiazepines?
And medical marijuana?
No, not medical marijuana, but benzodiazepines and opioids.
Well, in terms of me prescribing them myself, or with treating people that are already prescribed?
Your amounts are conservative, which, you know, I grant you. But
yeah,
are you aware of that interaction between opioids and benzodiazepines?
Yes. So you're speaking of my, for the
mesbot,
yeah, for the tramadol and the Xanax.
Right.
Yeah. I'm aware of it. I'm also aware that in such small amounts that we're giving for these people, and I do have medical histories for those specific, you know, people that were treated in office, and ultimately too, when we are at that office that I was working at, there's a medical, I am not the medical director at that particular establishment. If there is any doubt or someone had a sensitivity, we would also be contacting the medical director, who's a medical doctor. It's not a naturopathic physician.
And what are you doing now if you can't get into the PMP? Are you still signing the?
No. I mean, at the office when I'm doing certifications, I have always had my laptop, but for whatever reason, I think there's a little glitch not too long ago where it was updating or something. I do my intake and I have them sign the attestation. I do the other work, but if it's unclear, if I can't bring up their information at that time, I wait until I have access to the PMP to sign the certification. And there's times too, if I have not received medical records to confirm what their diagnosis is, then I do not sign and fill out that certification until I've received the medical records and such reviewed the PMP and then submit it to the company.
My concerns are basically, again, the form. We've had these cases before. Most of the time, we've come up with letters of concern, tailing something onto that. So,
but it is mostly in the.
The issue that, the main issue digressing is you can't sign that form unless you've actually done the PMP, because that's going to come right back and and then it's going to open up the issues.
Also, from a physician perspective, maybe somebody can discuss this. I was just curious, I saw the ages, and I know it was just a random assortment, but that concerned me, just there were so many, like, 18-year-olds.
And ultimately, I don't really have the sample that was, I don't know if it was random or not, but those six people that were chosen, two or three were, I think, 18 years old, and that does not represent the majority of my clientele. Most of my clientele are seniors. I do get some 18-year-olds, but it's mostly people that are older wanting to certify their card. So when that sample came up, I sort of thought, oh, geez, I know. Because I specifically remember that young woman coming in, her diagnosis, her complaints, and things like that, because as a physician that's been practicing for 18 years, of course I'm suspicious of an 18-year-old coming into my office wanting medical marijuana card. You have to have a very good diagnosis, and you have to have a physical exam supporting what your complaint is. Sure.
I do agree with you that that's obviously a concerning age group. Mm-hmm. I don't know if every single one of these. I do think that there was always a good representation on almost all of them of previous chart notes from other practitioners or, you know, supportive data. I don't believe that a single one of them was just you necessarily only making the diagnosis. So I think that was a good on your part to always, whether it was you or staff, always getting supporting data from previous visits or previous practitioners. What are the options? What are we thinking?
Well, you've got the option of letter of concern with CME. And then if you do the CME, what type of CME are you thinking of?
I would just say just medical marijuana specific, if we were to do that, just with regards to the applications and use of that and certifications for that.
I like the idea of CME on the case just because she spoke to the fact that she only shadowed for a couple hours, and maybe it would just be beneficial in general.
I think she's got a long clinical history, so I don't think more than 10 hours would be.
And I did attempt to complete the CME hours from the AZNMA website, but I was unable to gain entrance and the password and everything like that. So I was trying to do that retro, so I could at least present and say I've completed the 2017 and the 2015, which is presented on the AZMA website, because it's more specific to me for passing.
Yeah, the exact director for AZMA is behind us, so you can ask them.
Yes.
So I'll make a motion for a letter of concern. Mr. Gaslow, is your AZMA, do you have, how many hours of CME do you have available?
I think we've got a 2018 as well, and I believe that it's 6 or 6.5 hours.
And I know the University of Arizona has 6. So I'm going to kick that to board. Do you want 6 or do you want 12 for a CME on campus?
I'm still on 10 for whatever reason.
Okay. Well, you can dissect through that. You may get a couple more hours, but
okay.
Make a motion for a letter of concern with 10 hours of CME. That would be in addition to the CME already practicing 30 hours.
I have a general question. With the letter of concern, what does that represent in terms of a grievance towards your license and in terms of, is it public knowledge? And I'm also in a predicament of right now, I'm trying to get malpractice insurance, and that's a difficult thing. So
no, I understand.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering how that, because I haven't had a letter of concern.
The letter of concern is non-disciplinary, but I think board staff, after we finish the motion, we can call and they can go over kind of what the details of that would be with you.
Okay.
And can I propose a friendly amendment to the motion? One, to add time frame for completion, just so that you can follow up on this and it won't be ambiguous. And as well as the executive director mentioned that on your letter of concern, she'd like a little more specificity as to what the concern is.
Okay. can you get this done in 6 months?
Oh, easy, yeah.
Okay, so 6 months. And then the letter of concern would be based upon just quite simply, I think you understand cannabis and its mechanisms, but just the mechanics of PMP, medical history, et cetera. However, having the additional cannabis knowledge is probably helpful.
So yes. Whether concern for non-compliance with medical marijuana guidelines?
With the state guidelines.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So if there's a motion, we'll need some.
I'll second that.
And then
roll
Sampson.
Call, please.
Aye.
Dr. Spatt. Dr. Spatt. Ms. Gallen.
Aye.
Dr. Popio.
Aye.
Dr. Sadler.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's been requested we take a break. It's 1:21 and
I'll play later.
Okay. We'll reconvene at 1:30.
If it gets annoying.
I don't know that this rises to the level of disciplinary action, and that's what I wanted to discuss in terms of, I don't know that we've seen this doctor before, to my knowledge, since I've been on the board, since you've been here.
I appreciate their remediation. Yeah. She's kind of taken her own initiative to do. I don't know, you know, as far as if you guys think it's enough or if more needs to be taken, but I do appreciate when we see somebody come before the board and they see, they recognize that they've done something wrong and they've taken some steps to remediate that.
I don't envision anything more than a letter of concern, and I don't even envision CME hours at this point, given that she's already taken that class and is already not a part of your practice.
Correct, it's not. I have a recommendation. I just did a additional CME from Prime Med online. They're Prime Med West, and it was fantastic. It was called Cannabis Medicine Myth or Mistake. It was absolutely fantastic, done by an MD based on California, but I do recommend that maybe in the future. They have some very good ones on cannabis specifically, and I gained even more information off of that one. It's really good, especially if we're talking about minor, not minors, but the population between 18 and 21. You really focused on that, and that definitely changed how I feel about certifying that population specifically.
So there's a letter of concern mentioned. You've already done CME. Sounds like you've been part of the CME. Does anyone want to speculate how we would do the letter of concern, the basis?
Just so it's a letter of concern for failure to comply with the state mandated medical marijuana prescriptive practice. Can we leave it at that?
Okay. Is that a motion?
That's a motion.
I'll second that motion.
And Ms. Anthony, roll call.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Dr. Sadler?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we've made it through five. And let's... Has everyone had the chance to read the draft minutes? Or at least glance over them? Yes? Okay. Do you want to make a motion that we accept them as they were written?
Yeah, I make a motion we approve 6A through 6J.
Actually, our May 9, the second page.
What?
Oh, just keep saying
that. Oh, gotcha.
That I don't know.
Board members, I would just, before you approve all these, to the extent any of you can take a look at these, it looks like it's four dates. If any of you were not at one of those meetings, just let us know and stay out of that vote.
I was not at April or May.
On what date?
April 11th and May 9th.
April 11th and May 9th, you say?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did we want?
I missed January. I'm pretty sure.
You missed January. Do we want to pull these out then separately?
You could do it a few ways. I mean, you could. I would say just the cleanest way might be to just take D through J as a consent and then do those other three separately.
Okay.
So everybody was at the July 11th meeting.
Unfortunately.
Looks like there were a lot of executive sessions.
Yeah. Or, I mean, it would be okay if we just ran through A all the way through J.
Yeah, and just entertain the recusals as they come.
Yes.
So 6, A through J, who was not here?
I wasn't here on A.
Okay. Can we have, go ahead and approve 6A?
So moved.
Okay.
Aye.
Was a second?
Aye. And then looks like the other date in question was April 11th?
And the 9th.
And the 9th of May. So I'll make a motion for April 11th and May 9th, and that those who were not here will not be voting.
Make motion for approval. I'll second that motion.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So.
Aye.
All right.
I think that takes us through. Was someone not here July?
I recused for one, but I don't know if that is that obvious.
No, that should be in the minutes that you recused.
Yeah. So I think you can still approve the minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you were here.
Which one?
I don't think we can still approve the answer.
You mean D through okay. D through J. So D through J, those that were not here are obviously not going to be voting, but everyone was here at D through J. Okay. So I'll make a motion we approve D through J. That would be July 11th, 2019.
I second that.
Okay. Aye.
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 Thank you.
Okay. That ties that up. All right, and this goes over to number 7, and it's review, consideration, and possible action regarding the use of term specialists. So this was on the agenda for, you had questions, Dr. Lubin?
I don't have questions, I have issues.
You have issues, okay.
I have questions. So I'm going to do some iteration for our new Assistant Attorney General. I'm going to do some reiteration for those. I was trying to do two. Can you guys hear me? Okay, but maybe I have to record. I graduated Southwest College with Dr. Satterwhite in 1997, so just on 22 years. I focused in the world of HIV and oncology from day one. I was kind of forced into HIV by the school, but I practiced oncology specifically and nothing else for 22 years. I'm a board certified naturopathic oncologist. I'm proud of that title because in the state of Arizona, you cannot use the protected term specialist without recognition by this board. So to that end, and because this is my second board term, and back in the day, because I believe in protecting the public, not just from being on the board, but as a physician in the community, and just as an ethicist and a human being, we launched, and I became the founding president of the Oncology Association of Naturopathic Physicians in 2004. It was a big effort. It was the first of its kind in our profession. In 2006, and in 2004, the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians recognized us as an official affiliate organization. And in 2006, we had a first round of certification. I, of course, was part of the first 6 that was certified to become naturopathic oncologists.
earning the designation FABNO after my MD, and then recognized by the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians as having the highest expertise in naturopathic oncology
via the
physician paper 2006. Recognized experts. Fast forward, I served 5 years as president. The organization is, I think, the second largest membership organization in the profession. It's held 8 conferences on naturopathic oncology, and we have probably in the range of 130 board-certified naturopathic oncologists on the continent. I'm a board-certified naturopathic oncologist. This board recognized me in 2013, along with 8 others, and I think there's 13 in the state of Arizona that are recognized and can call themselves specialists. But this board allows others to use the term oncologist without being recognized as a specialist. I have a problem with that. And I have a problem because my argument is that it doesn't protect the public. I've stated my argument here for you to read, but I'd like to go over it. I spent a lot of time, a lot of energy being a specialist. I spent a lot of money. I spent a lot of effort. I made a lot of inroads in the community, and I've done a lot for this profession. And I'm not saying that selfishly, I'm just stating the fact. In bringing forth and inventing the term naturopathic oncologist, there are several organizations that have followed suit on the Oncology Association of Naturopathic Physicians. The endocrinology, the pediatric, the ortho, the psychology, the gastro, and they've all used our the bylaws that we created back in 2004 as examples, because they were accepted by the AAMP. So I'm putting forth to the board that the term naturopathic oncologist is a term that denotes specialization. If you recall, on one case, this board decided against that. It was not brought specifically, but this board, in a case I was recused for, decided that the word oncologist simply described to the public that you see people with cancer in your practice. Therefore, if I decided to call myself a naturopathic neurologist because I treated somebody with neuropathy secondary to chemotherapy, that would be okay. But I don't think it is. And I think this board should recognize other terms than just specialists, because I don't think it protects the public. A medical oncologist is unarguably the only specialist in allopathic medicine that specializes in medical oncology. The same is true for radiation oncology and surgical oncology. How does that differ in our profession? I don't think it should. I think a naturopathic oncologist is somebody who's recognized by boards to treat people with cancer and has the highest expertise. The national organization suggests it. This board recognizes the specialty. I want to protect the term. That is my argument. And I would like to discuss, however it turns out, why we think that a doctor can use a specialty-based term, in my opinion, when they're not a recognized specialist.
If you peel the word just oncology, obviously carcinoma cancer, is your rub the issue of oncology and then someone putting consultants after that? Or is it, do you feel as though it's not clarified as to what they're doing in terms of education and or license?
I think that if somebody uses the term oncologist, they are denoting specialist. That is assumed in the public that that is a specialist. That's it.
Would you be okay if they said, instead of calling themselves an oncologist, that they practice oncology? Would you think that denotes specialization?
Do you mean if I said, if I didn't have FAB and I said Dan would have been practicing naturopathic oncology? I think that that's a good start. Meaning, therefore, I couldn't say naturopathic oncologist, but practicing naturopathic oncology. I think that that's a start, because we don't have naturopathic oncology. Yeah, I would be okay with that.
Now, you have, I think, one of the things in here on the sort of new physician's name that you said, is an naturopathic physician specializing in the treatment of trauma, mood disorders, and chronic pain? It was another patient, or another physician saying that you're specializing in that. Do you have a problem with how that's termed? Would you like to say, hey, I'm worth focusing on that?
Absolutely. That is already, that is in our bylaws, or in our rules. can't, the board already knows that you can't use the word specializing in or specialist to denote your practice without recognition by this board. The only specialty this board recognizes is neurocognitive oncology. I hold certificate number one, I also hold certificate number two.
It's like if you're, it's a particular interest, you want them to say focusing in or having a particular interest in these particular conditions.
They can't use specialists. Gotcha. And I will be the first one to call them out because we've spent a lot of time, energy, money to do this, and it is to protect the public. It is unethical to call yourself a specialist without the training. I don't know how that's okay.
Okay, just for the discussion on this. So the one of the examples that we gave was the Dr. Alvin Dry that we have. The example that you get. So he actually went for additional training at the International College of Applied Kinesiology. So he actually did take additional.
That's fine, but he's not recognized by this board. If he wants to go through the process to get recognized, he can use the term specialist. The term specialist is already a non-issue here with me. You can't use it unless this board recognizes you as a specialist. What I'm saying is that this board said you can use specialty-related terms. I don't want that to be the case. So this guy cannot say he's specializing in the treatment because that is the word specialist, right? Or is this board okay with just saying you can't use the term specialist, but you can say you're specializing in it? The two are not mutually exclusive. So I'm okay with people getting advanced training, but if you practice in the state of Arizona, you can't use the word.
No, it's true even in other professions.
Right,
like I have advanced training in the long
break out
of the which is a specific area of law, and I don't have specialty in that area. I can't say I specialize.
So let's
even though I have more additional training.
You can advertise, you can say you did it, you focus in that area. I don't know that.
So let's say for this example, Dr. Allen. So let's say he changed the word specializing into focusing. Would that be appropriate?
Is this a question for the board, or is this a question for the
legislature?
That's a good
one. Let me, if I can, since I have two legal minds here.
Sure.
Are we just dicing words with specializing versus specialist? I'm trying to discern, the statute as opposed to some of the verbiage that people have in there.
Mark, I think we should be in executive session. Let's have a general legal discussion.
You want to go into executive?
I think so. Let's do that.
Okay.
That's
right.
I take a motion for executive session.
For legal advice?
Aye.
Yeah.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Who's there a second?
How do you do it? Do you go in the other room or do you make this
case?
Okay.
We should just turn it off.
Is he still there? Is he still there?
No, I made it both.
I would say that.
Okay, 2:13, we're back into regular session. Have we concluded number 7?
Yeah, it's just the point.
No, there's part 2.
Part 2 of number 7?
I wanted to bring up the case for expert consultants at the college.
That would be you moving on to 9.
I'm sorry.
Do you want to move on to 9?
Yes, I apologize.
Okay.
That's it for 7.
So we're done with 7, and we're going to move on to 9, then we'll digress into 8. So go ahead, Dr. Wilson.
Okay, so this board is, I see it, I'm relatively new. I think I'm a year on the board, but I've been at it before for 7 years. But I've seen that in opioid-related cases, we bring on an expert consultant. And I believe after talking to Gail and Dr. Satterwhite that that's because none of us are experts in that field, and we needed them. Well, the same is true that if I'm recused, there is no sitting expert in intrapatic oncology, very arguably so. And it's a very serious disease, such as opioid addiction, opioid-related deaths. There's cancer-related issues. And if you've seen by what I just brought up, there are people who I believe are less skilled and are not recognized by this board, and I think they're a threat to the public. I also think that this board is not necessarily suited to adjudicate a case where I'm recused, and I would therefore ask the board, in the cases where I am not available, that we bring on an oncology expert to opine on the case, much like we do an opioid case.
I believe, and let me confirm with Ms. Anthony, the reason we use the consultant for the opioids was because some of those cases we needed to shore up and move on to OWA, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Office of Administrative Hearings. So I think that's why we brought in additional consultants.
Okay.
I mean, if it's,
and I'm, regardless you know, of that, then forget what I said about, you know, comparing it to opioids. You guys don't practice oncology at all. You don't know. I mean, I've seen two cases that one that I brought and one that my associate brought. I'm not going to opine because that would be inappropriate, but based on those, I am asking for an oncology specialist to be brought in to look at the case because in my opinion, it requires specialty. It's one of the reasons I'm on here.
And if I may, Dr. Rubin, members of the board, that's assuming, though, Dr. Rubin, that you would have to recuse yourself on every case involving that topic. And if you don't have to, then there might not be a need to have an outside.
It was only on cases whereby I would be recused. That's what I said.
And maybe you want to take that up on a case-by-case basis as they come before you, rather than just kind of make a blanket statement.
In my statement, I mentioned only in cases where I'm not acting as a board member.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
No problem. No.
In some of the cases, too, digress to standard of care, and they start with standard of care, i.e., bad charting, not informing patient. There was 33% cure rate with this and that therapeutic. So I think a lot of it goes back to the issue of standard of care. But say it was a total naturopathic oncological problem that was treated with something that really wasn't within standard of care, that absolutely would
I brought a case before the board where I was the complainant demonstrating very clearly that a doctor that believed that this board licensed was false advertising and putting up false data. I recommended five different experts that this board could refer to. None of them were utilized, and the case was dismissed.
Was that case, but I can't digress into it, but was that a standard of care?
No.
Okay. Was it a patient brought?
No, I brought the complaint.
Yeah, you brought it. Okay. So, I think there are certain cases that we, whether it's an opioid or whether it's manipulation, whatever it happens to be, that we, as a board, can look at the general care standard of care was violated for these reasons. If it's more in depth, then I have no problem bringing somebody that's a specialist in that area.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And board members, if I may, the board always has the option, if you will, to, once the case is brought before you, if you feel you need more information, if you feel you want this to move to a higher level and you want somebody to look at it, you by all means have the ability to tell me to go ahead and have it referred out for a second opinion, if you will, or a report or whatever it may be. So just because it's brought to you, if you feel like you can't make a determination or you need further investigation or further information, you can do that at that juncture.
That would be like a case continuance or something? Perhaps, or you move it to an informal interview?
It would basically be tabled for further investigation, or further
okay.
Yeah, review, or whatever it may be.
Okay.
Then let's go back into number eight, review consideration of possible action regarding use of term board certified.
Oh, that was just that there was a couple of these that used the term board certified at the position. That term doesn't exist, according to the board, as far as I'm concerned. And I was concerned that that would mislead the public. They're licensed, but they're not board certified positions. And there was a couple instances that just websites that I had seen. And I was just wanted to bring it, knowing that, I mean, I'm a board certified naturopathic oncologist. Therefore, I'm a board certified naturopathic doctor, but there isn't such thing as a board certified. This board doesn't certify a license. Right? So they should change the term certified to license.
I think a lot of, especially the new grad, they don't know the terminology. So I think that's where the hiccup is. So I think if we educate them on it, and I think it's a minor thing that they can fix on that.
So would that mean that we should write a letter?
I was going to say, how is the education process, if that is, and I think that's probably very true, that new graduate is probably the group that's most at risk for doing things like that. What is the education process on these type of things? Is there in school at Southwest? Is there any education really for some of these pitfalls that, you know, even just some of the medical marijuana cases, like, it's getting old because they're just lack of knowledge. So how do we get into the, how do these doctors get into these positions? Is it just lack of education from school or not being educated and during rotations with other physicians? I don't know.
I mean, where I can see it becoming confusing is certification, the actual, what certification means. Have you looked that up?
The term certification?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's the action or process of providing someone or something with an official document, which would be, i.e., their license to practice, to a status or level of achievement. So, I mean, is it license versus certification that is your concern?
Okay. And then everybody's a board certified. I've never heard of a primary care. I mean, usually you get your licensed doctor and then you're board certified like an inspection specialist. I mean, that's just what we do. And I just, you know, we're a small profession. We've got a lot of people encroaching on turf. There's stuff to protect, and just, I'm trying to help make sure that we are not, have doctors brought before the board for news or whatever may happen, you know what happens. And for me, we're not board certified. I think that is just something that is loose, and it's not in accordance with how any other profession practices. And why would we do it? It just looks sloppy. Like I think the specialty thing looks sloppy.
Well, one of the physicians responded, and she said that she thought that if she being licensed by the board, then she thinking that's a board certified. So she doesn't know the terminology. Yeah. So I think what we can do is go back to SCIM and talk to them about it. Whoever the new licensed doctor that company in from out of state, we need to clarify the terminology as well. Because sincerely, I think one of those that people don't know about, they think, okay, if I got licensed here, I consider myself also.
I'll just add in that some of the other boards and I represent, similar issues will happen, and they're at least at the funeral board, for instance, sometimes the executive director will, you know, when these things are brought to her attention, she'll give a call or write a letter and kind of educate them in that way informally. If it appears to be just kind of a mistake.
From a legal perspective, do you believe that license and certification are synonymous to the public and therefore can be utilized?
No, from our statutes, I think that they're different, but I understand them. I could see how these newer practitioners might not understand them. I'd educate myself on it a little bit before today, but I think reading into our statutes, I think certified means, I'm looking at the term specialist as defined, it kind of says, so the specialist we're dealing with before means a physician who has successfully completed approved postdoc training, who is certified by a specialty board of examiners recognized by this board, and who is certified by the board to practice a specialty. So there's like three parts to that. So I think the second part, that's board certified, is when, at least the way I'm reading this, is by these boards that this board recognizes, the like your the oncology one. So you're not you could be board certified but not a specialist. But I don't think if you are just licensed, you're board certified. But I also don't think that a new graduate or doesn't understand the terminology would necessarily know to look into that definition. But so I do think it's an opportunity for the executive director or the agency to, you know, educate the public and
kind of, like a template letter, and if you come across those things, you wouldn't mind sending that out.
Right. So I think it's twofold probably that I can add something when they, because when they initially get licensed, it's like, congratulations, and here's, you know, information and websites that's going to be helpful. I can clearly add that. I can also do an email blast, but when the things like this are brought to my attention or I see it, usually I call the person and go, well, what does this mean to you? Because I'm curious as well. What does this term mean to you? And as you see from the two that I called the other day, one was like, well, I passed NCLEX, so I thought I could use this, or whatever it may be. So, you know, I just basically tell them, if you are certified in a specific area, and, you know, you can certainly say that, but just make sure it's like board certified in or by or whatever it may be.
But this board only recognizes one body making board certification, which is the FANP, so they can't really say that they're board certified in anything else, because that would be no specialist based on our terminology.
Well, you know, what do you do with someone? I have federal certification for FAA and Department of Transportation. It's board certified federal certification. So how do you start delineating the state versus the federal? I mean, you can really get snarled up in a mess. If it says Arizona board certified, then yeah, I think that could be a problem. And I agree, maybe clarification. But now I think you start dealing with people who have additional certifications that are granted federally or whatever. Where is
it medical? And so it's not in the jurisdiction of this board. Certification.
That's true. But if I had board certified, you know, follow along my site for what I do, is that, or anyone else that does this?
You mean board certified by the Federal Transportation Administration?
Right.
Yeah. That doesn't say anything about your physicianship to me. It means you're an accomplished individual who's also a naturopathic doctor licensed by the state of Arizona for the naturopathic examiner. That's how I would interpret it. I wouldn't have a problem with that. Just the use of board certified naturopathic doctor.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll just add one little tidbit to that is under our, again, looking back into the unprofessional conduct, I mean, again, depending on how the board wanted to take these things, so this is a 32-1501 31AA, falsely representing or holding oneself out as being a specialist, or representation by that the doctor is boarded or board certified that this is not true or that standing is not current. So, I mean, I guess the examples you gave would probably be potentially be a technical violation of that statute, but it does seem that it could be resolved by a kind of a lighter means and discipline. But should the executive director be unable to persuade these particular licensees to kind of clarify their statute, certainly something could be brought to the board and they could, you know, the board could address it via this AA subsection, because if you aren't in fact board certified, being licensed is not board certified, I'm comfortable with that. So should she not be able to get it done, you know, informally, I mean, theoretically this could be brought to the board for to deal with it in a formal manner. Again, depending on the case.
Wait, I didn't understand. I'm reading it again, and which example might be in violation?
Let me get down and find it. I was going off my memory from yesterday, so let me pull down and find which one I was looking at. Now, even looking at this, the first one, I'm trying to, since these aren't, people aren't on the agenda, I don't mention their name, but I'm looking at page 2 of this PDF, the natural solutions to your primary care needs are board certified naturopathic doctors. Again, if they're certified by a specialty board, that's different, but if they're just licensed by this board, I think that would potentially have an issue under that AA. This is,
I don't have one example.
I think that might be the example, because I'm looking at your...
Wait, is it what?
Never mind, I'm looking at, then there's the, I just want to say the names of them.
The other one was this question.
No, look at that, I'm looking at this one right here? You have this?
You gave that to me.
Oh. And then there's the next one, this this other one too. Sorry.
I only have the one with the picture.
It's a PDF that says board certified Rubin PDF.
I think in what she sent us there was one more, and then on this one.
Sorry. In that particular one, the second one mentions Dr. X, a board certified and licensed naturopathic doctor. So under AA, if you're representing your board certified, if it is not true or the standing is not current, and this person clearly sees that there is some difference, so how are they certified? I mean, but I do think under your statute, you can be board certified without being a specialist. It's kind of a prerequisite being a specialist.
You can be board certified without being a specialist.
Because specialist under our statute is defined as three requirements. One, successful completion of postdoc training. Two, certification by a specialty board of examiners recognized by the board. I guess I'm interpreting that number two as being board certified, and then three, certified by this board to practice a specialty. So I can envision a situation where you theoretically in that oncology organization you're mentioning, you could have got certified by them, and I wouldn't find that problematic to say board certified. But now that you've gotten this board's kind of blessing of it, now you're board certified and a specialist. So
this person is saying that they're board certified, but that they're not a specialist, but that some board certified them in something.
Potentially, I mean that's what that's implying. I mean,
you could literally, like Bruce was saying, be boarded in anything, and you're a board certified and licensed naturopathic doctor. But
certainly that'd be misleading board, if it was like the FAA example. I mean,
that board certification implies that it's attached to the licensure of it, or that it's attached to the naturopathic doctorship.
Yes, I agree. So if that's a false statement, that would...
Got it. Okay.
If it's true, that's fine.
But if they're board certified by some online course that is a board that certified them, they are therefore board certified and can then say that to the public and advertise that according to... It's legal. According to our rules.
It's a little bit of a gap in our rules there. I mean, a specialist requires the certification to be by a specialty board of examiners recognized by the board. But the actual term, board certified is kind of mentioned in our statutes, but it's never explicitly defined, so you're in kind of, we're in a little bit of a gray area.
You can say you're a board certified naturopathic doctor, and it's not implying that this board is certifying the doctor. It's certifying some board, certify them in something, maybe candy making, but they're also a naturopathic doctor. So they are a board certified naturopathic doctor, just not a naturopathic medicine.
Potentially, but if it was candy making, that would then fall under one of these other false, fraudulent, misleading advertising or something. So there's other ways to get at it. But
if they were theoretically board certified in PTSD treatment by an online course that we had a problem, one of us could develop a complaint, bring him in, have it explained, and we don't accept that, then we could say, well, you can't use the term board certified in reference to it. Are there any other boards that certify it, right?
Maybe, I don't know, I'd have to. I don't know if I'm prepared to answer that particular hypothetical, but I think that should there be a board certified issue that you find is misleading in some way, I think we've got to take it case by case and look at it and see what are they certified in, what are they representing, what does it represent to the public, is it misleading?
So essentially what I'm hearing is that if somebody's using the term board certified naturopathic doctor and they're using it in reference to their licensure, that's misleading. And they probably shouldn't do that. And this board should let them know. If, however, they come back and say, well, I'm actually board certified in X, yes, I'm a licensed naturopathic doctor, you might then decide to bring it to the board and say, this person is using the term board certified naturopathic doctor. It appears perhaps misleading that they're a board certified naturopathic doctor. They're board certified by this board, and we can decide if we accept it. I'm trying to protect this profession and the public at the same time. And I know our profession, and I know the internet and social media, and I am trying to do preventative medicine. It's one of my highest precepts in naturopathic medicine. And because it's my profession, and I'm on the board, and I don't want anything to happen with my name. So this is partially selfish, this is partially self-preservation.
I mean, my concern would be if somebody put board certified in orthopedic medicine, or board certified anesthesiologist. yeah, that's a huge problem. But I think it needs to be addressed, and I think we can tease it for a long time, but
what if they didn't say more to it, but what if they just said they had a CDL?
That'd be a problem. Why? Because that's a certain profession, sort of training to become an anesthesiologist.
So why is that not true for naturopathic oncologists?
I'm not disagreeing with the oncologist.
But you guys said it's okay to use the term naturopathic oncologist if it describes the type of people you see. And if I give local to do scar therapy, I can then therefore say, I'm an anesthesiologist.
Well, I don't think we're saying that's okay. I think we're saying that's what the statutes are saying.
So the board in that one case then, so it's, oh, but it is okay to use it.
Yeah, I think it's a case by case.
And that's very, very tricky because oncology to me would be the study of cancer and you specialize in that. So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying.
I have a real problem with it. But it sounds like, personally, I think it's ridiculous. I think that it's deficient in our rules. This isn't any fault of anybody here. Sounds like it's really hard to change. I think the board is allowed to limit use case by case basis if the board decides that. But it sounds like to change you got to lobby to get these things to change into a tight environment.
And maybe talk to the association. Ask him to clarify the terms according, or at least put the statutes up on it.
What's the association?
The guy sitting back there.
Oh, the AZA, just so there's knowledge, so the public is looking and they go, okay, well, that's not bad. That's important to lobby for those changes.
Would that be possible?
Absolutely.
Okay. Oh, you mean, I know the vice president.
Yes, you do.
Okay. Okay, that's good. Okay.
That work?
Well, thanks for discussing it. There's a lot of work to be done here, but I think it's in the best interest of this profession and the state.
I agree.
Okay.
Dr. Selig, yep. We may move on to number 11 because.
Number 11, then I'll digress. So this is 2020 budget presentation. And I take it, Susie, you're here for that. Hi.
So I'm Susie Myers. I'm with the General Accounting Office unit of the Central Service Bureau, and we do the accounting for your board. Actually, we process your payroll. We do your accounts payables. We deposit any revenue on your behalf with the treasurer, and we run the reports. So I just am going to pass these out, and then we'll go through them as you want to.
You know who you are?
I know who I am. Most days. So on the card, the back has a list of the phone numbers of my staff on the top there. So I'm Susie Myers. I'm the administrator of the bureau. And when I get this, then I will start going through this report. So there's a lot more to this report than just this summary page shows. We have listings of tables that have all of your expenditures, all of your revenue, and an entire data set that rolls up into this information. So if you want a deeper look at this, we can provide that as well. But so basically, how we're going to go through it, if you look, the top line is your appropriation and adjustments. And your appropriation for 2020 is $193,400. And you get those monies in quarterly allotments. So each quarter, you get the authority to expend $48,350. So it's important to understand the difference between appropriation and cash. Right, so if you look at the very bottom, well, just below that, two lines down, your beginning fund balance for your fund is $1,340,021. And that fund balance comes from revenues through your licensing, essentially. However, you don't have the authority to expend that unless the legislature gives you the authority to expend it. So your appropriation is the amount you can expend within the year. excuse me, my allergies are crazy. So this year your appropriation did increase by $6,000. That appropriation increase is based on the legislature identified additional increases that were going to be taking place, so to cover those costs. A portion of that is the rent increase in the building. So a portion of that $6,000 is for rent. A portion of it is the contract for the security guards went up, like the cost that we pay for security guards went up. So a portion of it is for that. And then there it was a health insurance. We're self-funded. The state is self-funded through health insurance, and the health insurance trust fund rate went up slightly. So that's basically the increase of the $6,000. So even though you have greater appropriation, you don't actually have additional expenditures, you know, additional decisions you can make based on that money. So then as we go down, the top section is your revenues. And I just based the revenues on last year. So last year you generated $366,000 of revenue. That being static, I put that in there. So we'd have to go through some growth trends to see if, you know, your licensure is increasing, is it staying the same? But I think, so just for this, we just put it as a placeholder. So you can see you're generating substantially more revenue than what your appropriation authority is, which is why year over year your fund balance is growing. So at the beginning of this year, we have that your fund balance is $1.3 million. By the end of the year, we anticipate that if you fully expended your appropriation, which is all you could do, right, because you can't expend more than you're appropriated, you would have over $1.5 million. So we like to keep at least 3 to 5 years of cash balance from your appropriation, right? So that if licensures went down or some other legislation affected your fund balance or the legislature decided to sweep some of the fund balance, that you'd have revenues there to still sustain the operation of the board. So you have a healthy fund balance. It is growing faster than your appropriation, so that might be something you want to consider. I don't know, you know, if you want to consider different options regarding that. So then your expenditures is the next section down. So we've estimated expenditures there. You're pretty straightforward if you're a small board as far as operation expenses are incurred. So your monthly operating is about $445 a month for your just normal phones, data, boards, that kind of thing. And then you can see in the last column that says adjustment, there's a $35,666 placeholder there. That actually is all of kind of the annual things that are billed, just one-offs, that we just put as a placeholder in the end. So that is your rent, your shared service costs for being in the building. Actually, our services are part of that one as well. And your risk management is part of that. Your AFIS charges are part of that. So based on that, we have your personal services and ERE. And what we have done those projections based on is Gail's salary, plus we did put in an additional quarter-time FTE. You actually have the authority for 2 full-time equivalent positions, but you actually don't have enough appropriation authority to actually staff 2 full-time positions. Yes?
I didn't understand. We have something for 2 FTEs?
You have the authority to have up to 2 FTEs. So you have, it's called a full-time equivalent authority. So in statute or in, like if you went onto the OSPB JLBC website, you can see in there that you actually have the authority to hire up to 2 people for the operation of the board. However, you don't have enough appropriation or have enough money to actually fully fund 2 positions. So what we have here is we have Gail fully funded plus a quarter time like admin level position at $10,000 for the year plus ERE's. So that would be if you hire someone annualized for $40,000. But we only had enough to put a quarter of a position into that. In addition, in that line, we have money allocated for you for board member pay. So that's already in that as well. And then the $20,000 that's in the P&O line under adjustments, that's based on the 4 anticipated hearings that you're going to have with OWA. And like if there were OWA hearings.
Where's that?
for the, so there's 20,000 in the professional and outside services line at the very end under the adjustment column. Can you see the, it's like right here on this
corner. Right-hand side.
So.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that 20,000 is a placeholder for, to pay the Office of Administrative Hearings for the hearings that may take place this year, as well as any anticipated like court reporting fees.
Expert witnesses, reports, yeah. We've come out of that. So every time I use, like, every time I send a case to an expert witness, have them reviewed, that all costs money, so that comes out of that budget fund, right?
So we don't always expend that full amount, but we put it there because we'd rather state that it could occur and have a placeholder for it. And then, but that's really the only thing that's currently in your budget that has any wiggle room, right? That isn't a set amount that we already know is going to happen and take place. So that's basically the information that's on this. Do you have any questions about anything here?
What happens if we don't use the entirety of our appropriations?
It goes back into your fund.
But we can't necessarily utilize it for next year.
No, you're, the time of your appropriation, right, is your 1 year standalone appropriations. So that at the end of the year, anything that's left goes back into your fund. Now we do have a 1 year administrative adjustment period where if you have bills coming in late or whatever, we can continue to pay those, but the cost or the goods or the services have to have been incurred during that like 2019 period right now. So you can see there's an admin adjustment line that's near the bottom on the left-hand side. And in July, we paid $2,217 out of admin adjustments. That would be coming from last year's appropriation for expenses actually incurred last year, because you still do have an appropriation balance left. And then on June 30th of each year, they sweep whatever was in 2 years ago and put it back into your fund.
So is there a way to come to the end of the year and look back and be like, hey, we don't have any expectations for any more expenditures coming from that year. We didn't spend what we were appropriated. Then can we decide if we want to use that money?
Absolutely. So as long as it's in the best interest of the state. So a lot of times there is end of year spending where maybe you do computer refresh or like, you know, okay, so we didn't use the full 20,000 allocated to OWA and we still have $7,000 left. What can we use that on? You know, do we need postage? Do we need new laptops? What could we use that would still be in the best interest of the state? Yes, you absolutely
interest
can do that.
The state, not necessarily pertaining to this board directly.
No, it does have to be for the board directly. So like you couldn't buy, there are certain things that you can't buy.
Like you can't throw a party.
Right, exactly, exactly. So you can, right, there are certain things that are against the law to buy.
Does somebody check what we want to do? If we think it's in the best interest of the state, do we have to prove it to somebody?
So
I'm curious about our money.
So
Gail knows that this is a big
Gail problem. Actually is the one that can has the signature authority to approve expenditures on behalf of the board, so that actually she holds that authority. However, it is our responsibility to make sure that anything she authorizes is valid. So I don't think we've ever run into this with Gail, but we have run into this with other boards where an expenditure is taking place that's illegal, that they can't actually do. So then when we go to pay the bill, we're like, we can't pay this. And then the executive director has to personally reimburse or pay that bill directly. So if we find anything that's an illegal expense, then we don't pay. Like, we will not process the payment. And
is that opinion, or is that a list of things that you just can't do?
So we follow what we call SAM, which is the State of Arizona Accounting Manual. It can be found on the Department of Administration's General Accounting Office website. It's lengthy. There's a lot of information in that. And then in addition to that, you know, we have statutes and rules and procedures. We do, and if there's something that we don't know, like we're just uncertain, but it just doesn't feel right, then I'll take it directly to like Clark Partridge, who's the state comptroller, who's actually in charge of the entire state's expenditure authority. Like at the end of the day, he's actually the one that holds that authority. It's been delegated out to the agencies. And he has policy advisors that like will review if we have specific the questions and give us input and insight. So, and then of course, at the end of the day, we do get audited periodically. So then the auditor general will come in, review all the expenditures, all the findings, you know, anything there. And if there's anything that we're doing incorrectly, then there will be a finding and we have to correct that action. So, and then there are, like, just for instance, it is a felony to overexpend your appropriation. So, I mean, it's not just
unintentional.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't matter. So we do, that's why we track this really carefully, and we're very, very careful at making sure that this information is correct and that Gail can make good decisions based on this information, because if she authorizes expenditures that overexpends the appropriation,
she can go to jail.
Technically. So, or if not, it would actually be her responsibility to reimburse anything over the appropriation. So, like, if she overspent $900,000, she can be held liable personally to pay that back. But we don't let that happen because we're very careful.
No, we don't let that happen.
Do you have any other questions?
Do we get to keep these?
Absolutely. If you have my card, so if you ever have specific financial questions that you want, or if there is a policy, or you have a question about travel, or anything, you know, that you would want reviewed, you can always let me know. You can email me, as well. I'm not sure if my email address is on there, but it's Susie.Myers, which is susie.myers@azdoa.com.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Susie.
Guys, need a break pretty much.
Yeah.
We'll do a break.
Hydration break.
Okay.
Dehydration break.
Let's take a 5-minute break. It's 2:51. The number 10.
I want to make sure that you didn't forget that.
Dr. Rubin, are you confused on this? Okay.
So
we're back to 10.
Okay.
Is there a concern with this one?
Or
she's
just
coming up to
work
cruise.
Cruise.
Yeah.
She's back in town.
Okay. So okay. I'll make a motion we approve certificate to dispense renewal for Mia Darling.
I'll second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carries.
11 we got done. 12.
I know this is what you look forward to every every meeting. Did anybody have any questions about the report or the legislation? Or?
So I have 7 things in it.
Page 2, paragraph 3. Do you have any questions?
No.
Okay.
Wow, okay.
Well, from the report earlier, so are we going to get a raise?
That's right.
Good luck with that.
Right. It's a fair question, right?
You're saying it all back. Everyone read the Senate, House bills, etc.
Okay.
Everyone knows we have cases in front of OWA.
Yeah, we have cases
in front of OWA. So our new assistant attorney general.
Yeah, and I'll start getting up to speed on those and kind of working with Sabrina to figure out what's going on and what needs to be done. And I mean, I've kind of got a brief briefing on them, but I really haven't delved into them, so we'll see.
Okay.
We'll get it
done. I'll update you.
Go
ahead.
I have a question. So there are a couple of NAPSPAC who retired. They want to know what's the process to renew their license again. And I say, I don't know. So I'm just.
Well, just tell them to contact me.
Yeah.
Are we in 13 yet? Because I actually do have a couple future things.
Future? Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Number one, is it rain or rain?
Grain.
Grain, thank you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. My whole life it happens, so it's fine with me. I'm fine.
Mr. Rain, is that good luck with that? Actually, is it sensible at all to try and put in for a raise anywhere, even for board members, above the $22 a year? That's one future agenda.
Wait, I'm sorry, say that again.
Is it possible that some of we can put in for a raise for board members?
I can certainly look into it.
I mean, is it dumb?
I think it's a statute.
Are you going to become personally responsible for it? Like, is this even.
stupid thing.
We'll talk about it in a future agenda item, but in a nutshell, it's set by statute, so as part of some other broad change, maybe. I mean, you know, they're all pretty low, these salaries. I mean, it's kind of, it's almost like don't pay you at all. Why even give me that? But
right. It's like, that's $22. Okay, that's number one. Number two.
I'm backing up, man.
Thank you. Number two, can we, based on what I asked Ms. Myers, talk about at the end of the year, see how much money we have, and maybe decide on equipment or something to do as a board? Like, it's our money. Why not use it, right? And, okay, so and there were questions I didn't ask her because it wasn't, so I just wanted to say, like, maybe we can put that on an agenda as we, in December or something like that, or whatever. I just don't know what the limitations are, but I'd like to use it if we can. Right? No?
Say that again.
I would like to use our money if we can. I can't imagine getting new equipment or something that's in the best interest of the state.
And we'll talk about it because I'll have more information on my planned IT upgrade. And I have a meeting Monday with somebody, so I was going to bring that to the board's attention next meeting. Have more information.
Number three is.
There's more.
Number three,
what are you talking
about? These are things. One, I've been making it is. Frankly, I'm sick and tired of spending my time on these medical marijuana things. And there's got to be some way that this board can preempt.
Yes.
It's rough, and we need to protect the profession. We need to protect this board. And I would love to conjure some way, maybe next meeting, that we can send out a blast or send it out every week for something. Or does that not work?
It's been done.
Well, and again, we can't discuss that. We can just put it on the agenda.
Okay.
So let's.
Hold that.
Sorry.
I don't know if this is a future agenda item, but I thought hydrogen peroxide was specifically mentioned in our rules, in our IV rules. I thought Craig put something in. No?
Our IV rules specifically state, they don't specifically state hydrogen peroxide.
Okay.
But we can talk about it.
Okay.
So you want to look at IV rules?
Well, look at IV solution.
Or IV.
Hydrogen peroxide.
Just
mainly
hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah.
But isn't there an area that talks about cesium peroxide and like two other things? Is that not there? I don't think so.
Okay. I went through that before this.
Okay. That's it.
I had one thing I just wanted to mention. Just because I brought it up earlier and I didn't want it to hang out there, it was the Dr. Salisbury from Agenda 5. From one of the other cases where it looked like something was done, maybe done wrong, or we should look into if there was a bigger issue there, or it was just the one kind of slip up.
Right, so that was about the.
The
versus. So, I mean, I haven't been notified by DHS that there's any kind of issue, but I can certainly ask them to check.
I just feel because it was there, we need to check it.
Are you referring to that certification?
Yeah, because the girl came before the board was the second on it, not the primary. So she didn't actually check the box, and then not both. But there was no PMP, and the box was still checked. So I think
you're
we need to kind of see that person who actually checked the box
to
make sure that it's not an ongoing.
Is that random by DHS? Who gives, how many certifications versus PMP? Or is it every single person certifying for medical marijuana, there's a corresponding PMP, how many PMP checks?
So I think it's a corresponding issue, and they only send us, like, there's a threshold that it's cut off, and they only send us, like, if it's over this amount.
Okay.
But I believe I can always call them and say, can you run an audit on this person?
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Any other future agenda items? Well, it's on there. Okay. Call to the public. Well, it's there, so we got that done. And it's 3:11, and we're adjourned.
All right, thank you, everybody. It was an easy first meeting. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Second, what you said on medical marijuana.